At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Andrew Bacevich has served and studied for a long time in the field of arms and war, as a U.S. military officer, as a scholar of history and global power. And the evidence is overwhelming, he says, that the United States is too ready for war, anywhere, all the time. It's a mindset and a machinery that is not helping the country, he says. This hour on Point, Andrew Bacevich on America and war. You can join the conversation. How do you see it? Readiness as wisdom or war as a trap for this country? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is Andrew Bacevich, retired Army colonel, West Point grad, served in Vietnam and the Persian Gulf, a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His son, First Lieutenant Andrew Bacevich Jr., died in May 2007 in Iraq from injuries caused by an IED. Professor Bacevich's new book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Andrew Bacevich, welcome back to On Point. It's good to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me on the program.
You've been beating this drum, and I don't mean a war drum, for a while. Your education, as you write in the Washington Rules, goes back a ways. What's the new angle you're bringing to your insight on this country's sort of military posture, Professor?
Well, you used a couple of, I think, very useful terms in the introduction when you referred to a mindset and a playbook. And I think what the book, this book, tries to do is to explain the origins and evolution of both of those, the mindset and the playbook, and to make the case that these routines that to which we've been committed in our national security policies don't work anymore and need to be scrapped. And if I could briefly outline that mindset and that playbook.
Yes, please.
It would go like this. The mindset, I call it the American credo, is a conviction widely shared in Washington that the United States is called upon to lead, to shape, to save, to transform the international order. And in order to achieve that grandiose purpose, we do adhere to a playbook that in particular shapes our understanding of how to employ military power. And the playbook, mm-hmm. which I referred to as the Sacred Trinity, consists, first of all, of the conviction that the United States and the United States alone needs to maintain a global military presence, that the United States should configure its forces not to defend the country, but to provide instruments of global power projection, and that finally that global military presence and those global power projection capabilities should be married together to support policies of global interventionism, and that that's the basis of how we behave in the world, and really that's really, I think, the most important explanation for how we find ourselves in faraway places like Afghanistan.
I think a lot of people will hear that posture, that sacred trinity, as you unhappily describe it, and think, well, that reached its apogee in the George W. Bush years. But you say this is Republican and Democratic posture.
Well, I think, again, that's something that's very important for us to appreciate, that the debate over national security policy should not, in my view, be particularly informed by partisan loyalties or partisan views. that there has been this consensus in the realm of national security that evolved in the immediate wake of World War II, back in the early days of the Cold War. And administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, have chosen to sustain it, down to and including the present administration of Barack Obama. I mean, President Obama, when he ran for office, promised to change the way Washington works, and certainly in some respects, particularly I think in domestic reform programs, he has made some headway in that regard. But when it comes to national security policy, he has emphatically not changed the way Washington works. And I think that his pivotal decision in December of 2009 to escalate the Afghanistan war, which has now become Obama's war, really was the moment when it became clear that he was embracing what I call the Washington rules, and that there would not be any significant change in that realm.
Andrew Bacevich, we've listened and learned from you for a long time, but there is an element, a new element of boldness I'm reading in this book. I mean, when you go not just at military spending or at the sprawl of American bases or the number of American wars, but you go at what you call the American credo, the sort of idea that America must lead, that seems so fundamental. I know you have many people, who many admirers and supporters, but you may lose some people there who think, well, you know, this country was born with a special kind of advancing of global politics. It brought democracy in a new way, literally, to the world. You know, a lot of people think if America doesn't lead, that way lies chaos, darkness, I don't know, rollback.
Well, they do think that. One of the reasons that I choose to use this kind of religiously
tinged phrasing,
tinged language, credos and trinities, mm-hmm. is trying to express the notion that there's really very little empirical evidence to suggest that the United States is called upon or must lead. These are matters of faith. And I would also argue, and argue really very strongly, that in our history, there was a time when this kind of faith did serve our interests. You know, the insistence that the world is to be informed by American values that we insist are universal values helped to impel the strategy of expansionism that brought us to the summit of wealth and power. Wasn't particularly a morally justifiable enterprise in many cases, but our ideals provided a justification for our rise to the summit of power. My view is that that's no longer the case, that the insistence on playing this role, and I think the events of the past decade certainly support my views here, the insistence on playing this role and on placing such emphasis on the use of military power as the means whereby we exercise leadership is reducing our power, is undercutting our prosperity, probably is compromising our own claim to liberty here at home. So what used to work no longer works. And a pragmatic people, we used to think we were a pragmatic people, mm-hmm. a pragmatic people would be able to face the facts, and in recognizing the facts, would be able to change behavior. One of the things that's so, I think, both surprising to me and frustrating is that the facts stare us in the face and we choose to look away.
If the pursuit or the promotion of American ideals, you know, once powered the country's rise, however checkered that may have been, why is that not working now, in your view?
Because I think the world has changed and our place in the world has changed. I mean, I was born in 1947, really at the dawn of the Cold War, at a time when our power and our influence really had reached their zenith. In 1947, we had the money, and people came to us as supplicants, asking for loans and assistance. Back then, we made the stuff, whatever the stuff was, mm-hmm. and other people bought it. The trade balance was always in the black. The gold was in Fort Knox. That's not the world in which we live today. Today, they make the stuff. We insist on buying it, even though we can't afford to pay it, and therefore we go ever more deeply into debt. And we imagine that somehow the aggressive use of military power, we, Washington, imagines that the aggressive use of military power can somehow sustain a relationship which I think really has become unsustainable. So the bottom line is we don't live in the world of 1947 any longer. Again, facts staring us in the face that we wish somehow to not acknowledge.
So you say we can't live any longer with this military posture. This is too big a question. We've got just a minute before the break, but can we live without it? I mean, are we just sitting ducks without it? Americans have been heard for years and years and years, all the political talk about military readiness, readiness for any eventuality. If we didn't have that, what would it mean?
The alternative to military overextension is not disarmament. I mean, I believe that we need to have a strong and effective military. I think that effectiveness derives in the very first instance in recognizing exactly what force is good for and where the use of force is inappropriate. I mean, to get to specifics, we're engaged in a war in Afghanistan. It's now 9 years old. It's basically based on the premise that we have the capacity to determine the fate of the Afghan people. I think that that's a preposterous notion. And yet that sort of thinking continues to prevail across Republican and Democratic administrations, despite the fact that we've already spent hundreds of billion dollars with limited return.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's ever readiness for war with historian, strategist, and retired U.S. Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich. His new book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Joins us today from Portland, Oregon. Andrew Bacevich, lots of listeners lining up to speak with you. Salt Lake City, Utah. Jim, you're on the air with Andrew Bacevich.
Andrew, I have a message for President Obama. When we elected a change man, my suggestion is Andrew should be the Secretary of Defense. I mean, he is change, and so far all we've got is the same old thing. My question is this. With the entire establishment of the military and the industrial complex and the National Security Agency, they just seem impenetrable to change. And I'm wondering if it's even possible that anybody can change this. There's so many special interests. There's so much money. The complex is so deep that is it changeable by anybody?
Thank you, Jim. Andrew Bacevich.
Well, I'm pessimistic, and I don't see that there's any reason to pretend otherwise. And I think Jim puts his finger on an especially important issue here. The Washington rules, in my opinion, don't work for the country. They are not making us safer. They are not preserving the American way of life. They probably are compromising the American way of life. But the Washington rules work for Washington. They deliver profit to the military-industrial complex. They provide a rationale for the institutions comprising the national security state to claim prerogatives, to justify their budgets. They provide opportunities for ambitious officials and military officers to imagine that they are occupying the cockpit of history and doing important things. And so in that regard, it is simply the case that Washington is deeply invested in sustaining the Washington rules. And that deep investment is one of the reasons why the Washington rules resist change, even as evidence piles up that those rules, that playbook, that mindset no longer works. Now, were we, the people, able to ask first-order questions? Were we able, for example, to ask the question, does the American global military presence enhance global stability? Or does that presence, in fact, create instability in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan? Were we able to take that on, then perhaps we could become less deferential to Washington's claims that there exists no alternative to the Washington rules. But I'm sorry to say that we the people have been conditioned for so long to accept the mindset and to accept the playbook that critical thinking simply does not exist the way it needs to mobilize democratic forces to force our governing classes to begin to think differently.
Well, we try to be all about first-order questions right here. I want to look more at Washington rules, and I appreciate the call from Salt Lake City. Let me get one more right here first from Fairfax, South Carolina. Martin, you're on the air with Andrew Bacevich.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm happy to be with you. I served as a chaplain under Andrew in the Persian Gulf. My question for Andrew is this. You're talking about the post-World War II era, Andrew. What conflicts that the United States has been involved in since World War II would you categorize as having been appropriate for our nation to have fought, and which ones would you say were inappropriate?
Thanks, Martin.
Well, we've been involved in so many conflicts and interventions. We'd probably take up the rest of the program just running down the laundry list. But I think the key thing I would want to argue is that, first of all, it's not that I'm a pacifist. It's not that somehow I'm in favor of pulling up the drawbridges and sort of hunkering down in Fortress America. But I would say that even in those interventions where you could make the case that they were appropriate, I'm thinking here of Korea in 1950, mm-hmm. we see evidence of how the Washington rules, again, that mindset and that playbook, produce misjudgments where things go wrong. Let's get down to specifics, relate to Korea.
Okay.
You can make the case that the intervention in 1950 was necessary to sustain the larger strategy of containment. We needed to show that containment was not just words, that it was actions. But once we had successfully ejected the North Koreans from South Korea by the early fall of 1950, Washington succumbed to the ideological vision of liberating the North and reuniting the Korean Peninsula.
But it hadn't been North and South.
That infatuation produced the intervention of the Chinese in a war that ended up being much longer and much more costly than it needed to be.
So are you saying we would be better off to split the difference in the Cold War period? I mean,
I'm not sure.
Do you just divide the peninsula? I mean, it's what we ended up doing, but would that have been the right goal in the first place?
Emphatically yes. Emphatically yes. Again, it is to recognize to some degree, the key is to recognize the limited utility of force. Mm-hmm. Force does have a certain utility, but force does not have anywhere near the usefulness that American policymakers have tended to attribute to force. I mean, here I think the greatest example really is the thinking in the George W. Bush administration after 9/11, where people like President Bush and those around him fancied that American military superiority could be mobilized in order to bring about some vast transformation of the Islamic world. And that blew up in our faces, and we are still dealing with the consequences almost a decade later.
Our caller Martin served with you in the Persian Gulf. I think his question, though, may be useful in a way to at least look at some of the other major military conflicts since World War II and get your assessment of them. I mean, he's asking, were there some that were worthwhile? Were there any? Which ones would you have said no to right off the bat? Helps us picture how the world might have looked different, what the Bacevich approach might have been.
Well, I have to say that it's, to my mind, that the most successful elements of American strategy that did feature military power were situations where military power was held in readiness rather than actually employed. And this really does get to the strategy of containment. I mean, the period immediately following in the Truman administration, the period roughly between 1947 mm-hmm. and the beginning of the Korean War, 1950, a period of tremendous creativity, of the creation of NATO, of the Marshall Plan, of the Truman Doctrine, when the United States said that our intention is to provide a cloak of protection for Western Europe so the European democracies could begin to recover from the effects of World War II, yet executed in a way that we didn't have to involve ourselves directly in a conflict.
What about when the cloak fails? You served with Martin in the Persian Gulf. What about the Gulf War and Saddam Hussein in Kuwait? Appropriate intervention or not?
I really don't. I don't want to sound like I'm waffling. What I want to do is to sound like I want to recognize the complexity of these matters.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, it is absolutely true that there was justification for the intervention that became Operation Desert Storm in order to demonstrate that aggression of the type that Saddam Hussein initiated in August of 1990 was unacceptable in the post-Cold War world. On the other hand, we need to acknowledge that that ostensibly successful war, ostensibly successful in the sense that we liberated Kuwait, led directly to a much larger military presence in the Persian Gulf, to include U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia, and that that expansion of the global military presence post-Desert Storm did not increase stability in the Persian Gulf. In fact, served to foster the jihadist animosities that a decade later found expression in 9/11. So it is not mm-hmm. yes or no. It is not black and white. It is not up and down. There are complexities and there are complexities that rise out of wars, unintended consequences
mm-hmm.
that again should serve us to be should cause us to be cautious, careful. To reserve the use of force only for the most important purposes, and to avoid wars if at all possible.
Let me raise.
I think the key thing. The key thing, Tom, is
yes.
We imagine, Washington imagines
mm-hmm.
that war can be controlled. My own sense is that once we unleash the dogs of war, nobody, not the commander in chief, not the Secretary of Defense, not General David Petraeus. Nobody can say with assurance that the results can be predetermined and that the course of events can be predicted and that the costs can be anticipated.
So unleashing the dogs of war brings with it one kind of chaos. Let me just raise the other kind, because it's the bugaboo that's always put up against this argument, and that is the Munich argument, the appeasement argument. You think it's chaotic to have war? Let Saddam Hussein run roughshod over the oil fields of the Middle East, and look what kind of chaos you have then, America with no lights on. What about that argument? Without the big power, without the stick and the, you know, walk softly but be ready to use it, you face, aggressors on all sides.
Well, the problem with the Munich argument is that it is overused. I mean, we don't live in an age in which Nazi Germany and Adolf Hitler are preparing to overrun the world. Again, in the wake of 9/11, when this term Islamo-fascism was coined in order to describe the new adversary, when people in the George W. Bush administration did depict Osama bin Laden as the new Adolf Hitler.
And Hussein,
Saddam
Hussein.
All of that vastly overstated the threat we faced, and that vast overstatement of the threat I think, produced a strategic miscalculation.
Let's get a call from Liz in New York City. Liz, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Tom and Colonel Basevich. I wanted to comment that I think that, as in most things that we do as the world's superpower, what we need more of is humility. And I do think that the U.S. is a leader in this, in their U.S. Peace Corps efforts. And I'm a big advocate of doubling, tripling, quadrupling that effort. I know that they don't go into dangerous places, but if they did go into Afghanistan now, and not, this wouldn't replace a well-armed army, but to go in there and to build the Greg Mortensen schools, I think that there would be a lot of people, like myself, I would be first in line to do this, who have the bravery but don't have the desire or the capacity to be a soldier, but would love to go into those countries. And I think if we went in that way with, you know, without guns, with living in, with families in remote areas, learning their language, speaking with them, building their schools, listening to them and helping them build projects that, you know, they own and benefit from, is a very, very powerful tool.
Liz, let us pick that up. Andrew Basevich, how about it? The Greg Mortensen Three Cups of Tea Wake. Is there a Peace Corps alternative to the U.S. military presence around the world? Or is that, you're a former military man, does that sound naive, or does it sound like the way to go?
Well, I think it opens up a rich vein of conversation. In other words, if one would just stipulate for the sake of argument that relying on military power is not an effective way to fulfill our mission, whatever our mission happens to be, then what are the alternatives? And Liz describes one. Liz describes the alternative of emphasizing soft power. But Liz's argument is one that credits us as a people, as a nation, with the capacity to understand, let me put it in the crudest terms, to understand what they need and to deliver to them, whoever they happen to be, what they need. I have to say I'm a bit skeptical about our ability to do that, especially when we're dealing across very large cultural divides.
So you'd pull the plug on the Peace Corps, too?
I think another approach... I mean, pardon me?
You'd pull the plug on the Peace Corps,
heavens,
too?
No, I think the Peace Corps is a wonderful thing.
But isn't it based on the idea?
I would quadruple the size of the Peace Corps. I simply don't believe that efforts along those lines will have really a very decisive effort in changing the conditions that exist in places like Afghanistan. But yes, indeed, let us do that. The point I was going to get to, however, is that it seems to me that the other way of thinking about how we can best achieve our mission, however defined, is by serving as an exemplar. I mean, if indeed liberal values have universal application, then could it not be that the most effective way for us to lead would be to live up to exemplify the values and the aspirations that are expressed in our founding documents? And I would argue strongly that we have a long way to go in that regard, and that greater emphasis on living up to our own values not only would be good for the American people, it also might be actually more doable, but it could indeed provide us with the means to lead, a means to lead, that would be more effective than sending 100,000+ American soldiers to Afghanistan and leave them there for a decade.
And when those values meet illiberal forces, whether they be jihadi or, for that matter, perhaps mainland Chinese, what then?
Well, you're certainly conflating two quite different things
with
jihadis and Chinese. But let's talk about the jihadis.
Hold the thought for one moment. I always ask too big a question just before the break, and I'm sorry for that. Andrew Basevich, we have to take a short one right here. We'll come back and look at that. And I don't mean to conflate, but they're not exactly necessarily liberal polities, either one. Andrew Basevich's new book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's ever readiness for war with historian, strategist, and retired U.S. Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich. His new book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Andrew Bacevich, I think you were going to perhaps an alternative approaches on the jihadi front, or maybe even one day the Chinese front. Not to diss China, but they have a quite different political system from ours.
Sure. I think it's important to discriminate between those two problems.
And we do.
Let's take up the jihadis first, if we could. Let's understand that the essence of the strategy undertaken by George W. Bush and I think now largely embraced by President Obama, at least in Afghanistan, is based on the conviction that the invasion, occupation, and transformation of countries relying on American military power provides the best way to deal with this threat. That's what we've been trying to do for almost a decade now, and I'd say it's cost a lot, hadn't delivered much in terms of positive results. My own proposal would be that, first of all, we recognize that the jihadist threat is real but not existential. They have limited capabilities. The most important thing we can do is to defend ourselves, to erect effective defenses. We did not have effective defenses on September 11, 2001. We had our front door wide open and basically said, come on in and steal the family silver. So effective defenses combined with, at times, some variant of the counterterrorism approach that in Washington these days is basically associated with Vice President Biden. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, the notion that if there are gangs of thugs who are gathering in some place, preparing to conspiring against us, then yeah, we should reach out and we should deal with them in an effective way. The notion that we can eliminate the sources of jihadism, the alienation, the animosity, the internal problems that afflict that part of the world, the notion that American power can fix that part of the world is preposterous. So it's a limited threat that requires more limited means and can therefore be pursued on a more sustainable basis than the strategy that we have, in fact, been pursuing since 9/11.
If we can hold the bigger power picture for a moment, we have questions on this front. One from Westboro, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air with Andrew Bacevich.
Hello, Professor Bacevich. Thank you. I'm a great admirer of your work. I just want to ask you about Afghanistan and the purpose that President Obama stressed in his speech at West Point in announcing the new policy on Afghanistan, namely trying to make sure that we don't have a destabilized Pakistan because of its nuclear arsenal. Could you speak to the question of how the Afghanistan effort relates to Pakistan, and if that's not the way to help stabilize Pakistani nukes, what might be?
This is a great question, and indeed, the fate of Pakistan is far more important to us than the fate of Afghanistan. And we should ask ourselves, over the course of our 9 years in Afghanistan, has as a consequence of our policy in Afghanistan, has Pakistan become more stable or less? And to ask the question is to answer it. If there ever was an example of how adherence to the playbook is producing consequences exactly the opposite of what was promised, I think Pakistan provides an illustration. So what can we do? Again, I think we need to begin by recognizing the limits of American power here, but we need as much as possible to encourage and cajole a very weak Pakistani government and a Pakistani military that is not easily influenced. We need to nudge them to recognize the importance of dealing with the insurgent threat within their midst. We can offer advice. We can offer military assistance. We can offer encouragement. At the end of the day, the Pakistanis are going to have to deal with the problem on their own terms.
What do you do with the unnudgeable problems, though? I mean, here's A.Q. Khan exporting nuclear weapons from Pakistan in his day. Here's al-Qaeda making a base on that Afghan-Pakistan border and with its own kind of, you know, what can seem like imperial ambitions. Well, you know, what do you do if you come up against unnudgeable problems, potentially nuclear armed?
Well, with regard to the nuclear issues, and I think actually probably Iran here becomes mm-hmm. the case at hand more than mm-hmm. more than Pakistan, at least at this particular moment. Again, I'm not going to try to tell you that this is somehow easy. I myself believe that if there is an Iranian nuclear program, something which we don't know for sure, that comes to fruition, that there's a high likelihood that we can deter Iran, just as we deterred the Soviet Union during the Cold War, the possessing the capability and expressing the determination to retaliate in kind against the use of nuclear weapons by an Iranian regime would in all likelihood, I think, cause them to do the right thing, as it were. Now, I would also hasten to say, I'm saying that as an American, and Iran does not pose a threat to the United States, I can understand that were I, for example, an Israeli Jew, I might take a somewhat different view of the matter. That from Israel's perspective, deterrence may not be sufficient as an answer to an Iranian program. So I'm not going to discount the possibility that our Israeli allies may take a different view of things.
But would adopting your preferred military posture in the world mean then cutting loose allies like Israel, because we wouldn't necessarily have the capacity to provide the same umbrella? And do you think this country can, should, would do that?
Well, again, I'm not sure what in your mind is my military posture. It is not one that would cause us unilaterally to get rid of our nuclear weapons capacity. I'd like to see the abolition of nuclear weapons. It's not something that we can do simply on our own, so we would retain, I think, a modest nuclear retaliatory capability. But let's get to the whole question of cutting loose allies and cutting loose, as you use the term, Israel. At the end of the day, the government of Israel will do what it believes is in the interests of Israel. At the end of the day, Israeli leaders don't sit around a table and ask themselves what actions they should take on behalf of the American people. And it seems to me at the end of the day, the same sort of logic and perspective need to prevail in the United States. When President Obama takes an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, if you look at the Constitution of the United States, the preamble says that the purpose of our union is to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. His legal and moral responsibility is to the American people. And I think we need to recognize the fact not only that Israel is going to do what it views in its own interest, but Israel is a powerful country. It is the most powerful country in the Middle East by almost any measure. I'm not advocating cutting them loose, mm-hmm. but I also would not want our ability to do what makes sense to be artificially constrained by an argument that we have obligations to Israel or anybody else should take precedence over what serves the interests of the American people. And again, I would emphasize that there really is a core moral issue here, that the purpose of the Union is to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. And I'd also in particular want to emphasize that the path down which we are going is one in which we are placing at jeopardy the possibility of securing the blessings of liberty for our posterity, because we're going to bankrupt the country if we persist in engaging in endless wars.
Turn then to big powers and apply your sort of alternative worldview to the one Washington rules that prevail now. Look at the U.S. vis-a-vis China. Look down the road. What do you see as the most effective military face to show in that kind of direction?
Well, you know, and again, I mean, you pose the question, I'm not trying to be antagonistic here, Tom, but I mean, you pose the question by implying that the military question is the one vis-a-vis the People's Republic of China, for example, that needs to be dealt with first.
No, but it's the one you raise in the book, so I'm looking at how it applies.
Well, but what does China want? That's probably one of the big questions of the 21st century. To what does China, as a great power, aspire? I see no evidence in Chinese history that China aspires to impose or export Chinese values around the world. They're not trying to make the people of Latin America live consistent with Chinese values.
Well,
what they would seem to want is to develop themselves, and they appear to believe that development means that they need to have access to markets and access to resources in order to sustain their economic engine. And those aspirations will probably, already are to some degree, bringing them into conflict with us and with other powers. It doesn't seem to me that those conflicts necessarily have to have a military aspect. In other words, bottom line is, I think that the competition with China, which largely occurs in the economic realm, is likely to continue to occur largely in the economic realm, and therefore to privilege the question of how much military power do we need vis-a-vis China and how should it be shaped, I think probably invites a circumstance in which we could court a military competition that may not be necessary.
Speak then to what your picture of a U.S. military posture capacity would look like. Secretary of Defense Gates is talking this week about cuts, about cutting out a command, about cutting $100 billion in defense spending over the next 5 years. He's talking a lot about cutting spending. But there may be a difference in scale between what he's describing and what you're envisioning. Give us a sense of how those might compare.
Oh, I think that I'm probably not able to give you a dollar figures. I mean, currently we're spending somewhere in the vicinity of $700 billion a year, which is roughly what the rest of the world together spends. But let me try to answer the question in terms of posture. I would initiate a long-term, and I emphasize long-term, gradual, step-by-step, a reduction in our global posture, meaning I would begin to identify the places where the U.S. global presence is redundant, where it's not needed. And I'd probably begin by pulling U.S. forces out of Europe, for example. Europe clearly able to defend itself. This is a long-term project to begin to draw down that presence. I think that in terms of capabilities, I would want to maintain a very robust United States Navy, because I think the United States Navy plays a tremendously useful role in maintaining stability in the global commons. So I would probably have a larger number of surface ships, a smaller number of carriers. I mean, the purpose of a carrier these days is not so much to protect the sea lanes, but to provide a capability to project power against land targets. But we want the seas to continue to be accessible, and the best way to do that is to have a strong Navy.
Is there a percentage you could put on spending? I mean, would you cut it by half? Can you even begin to outline?
Sure, yeah. I mean, again, I wouldn't want to be sort of held to any particular number, but I would imagine that we could easily have the size of the defense budget If we abandoned the playbook and the mindset and embraced a more sensible basis of policy,
what would we lose and what would we gain with that?
And we would still be we would still have the largest defense budget in the entire world, by the way.
What would we lose and what would we gain if we made that cut?
We would forfeit opportunities to do mischief. What we would gain, I think, would be the opportunity to reimagine our place in the world and our place in history. In a sense, it kind of goes back to the point that Liz was raising. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the reasons that soft power, which she believes in, and I don't in particular, one of the reasons that soft power opportunities or options tend to be discounted is because so much emphasis and so much faith is placed in hard power. If we began to distance ourselves from the mindset that emphasizes hard power, then perhaps we could become more creative, either in using soft power, as she proposes, or in serving as an exemplar, which I would like to see the principal manifestation of our global role. But we are locked into a set of practices and habits to which Washington remains committed for its own reasons, even though those practices no longer serve the interests of the American people.
Andrew Bacevich's new book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He joined us from Portland, Oregon. Andrew Bacevich, come again. Thank you very much for your time today and your thoughts.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby, with help from Britt Hansen and Evelyn Radigan. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.